Hi, I'm Lorraine Raff.
And I'm Linda Lowen.
Welcome to Take Care, a weekly conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. On today's show, we've all heard of male pattern baldness, but do women experience age-related hair loss as well? We talked to a dermatologist whose research into hair health and disease is internationally recognized. How and why does hair loss occur in women as they get older? And do blow dryers and other hairstyling tools add to the problem?
But first, making sure your skills and knowledge are up to date is essential in our fast-paced world. Teachers stay current with in-service training, and in many states, lawyers can't practice without continuing legal education. So, how do doctors keep up with current medical practices and the latest advances? Are there continuing education credits, refresher classes, skills updates that need to be met? Who oversees this, and how is this administered?
Joining us to explain how continuing education works for medical practitioners is Dr. Atul Grover, Chief Public Policy Officer of the Association of American Medical Colleges. Trained as a general internist, Dr. Grover holds faculty appointments at the George Washington University School of Medicine and the Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health. Welcome back to Take Care, Dr. Grover. It's great having you as a guest.
Thanks for having me again.
Most patients are probably not aware that their medical practitioner is required to take continuing education in their field. How does that work?
So licensing requirements are different across states for physicians, but the vast majority of physicians have to complete what we call continuing medical education, or CME, hours. And in most cases, they have to do 25 to 50 hours of that continuous learning every year. There are other certification standards that are also in place for physicians that vary by specialty. So as a general internist, I have to recertify within my specialty every 10 years. But for my license in Maryland or Virginia or DC, I have to do these 50 on average hours of medical education each year as well.
Who oversees the process? And also, who sets the curriculum and standards that are followed?
There's a great deal of flexibility, as you can imagine, within continuing medical education because different physicians have different needs. One of the things that we have tried to do over the years with our physicians and having them be lifelong learners is also be lifelong evaluators of themselves and their own medical knowledge. So that's one of the reasons there's a lot of flexibility in a lot of different subject areas because as a general internist, I may know my infectious diseases really well, but maybe I need to brush up on my lung disease or kidney disease. And so I can identify those courses which I really need to make sure that I stay at the top of my game across my specialty. The accrediting bodies for continuing medical education, there are several. One is the Society for Academic Continuing Medical Education, or SACME. That's got about 350 members, and most of those members are medical schools and teaching hospitals that really focus on how do you make practice better. There's the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, which accredits the actual provider of continuing medical education. So our Association of American Medical Colleges is a partner in that organization. Many of our medical schools are not only accredited to deliver education to their medical students, but also to practicing physicians in all these different areas of continuing medical education.
So in terms of those CME hours, which can vary from 25 to 50 hours annually, there would be different requirements across the different specialties. And is this something that's required of all levels of practitioners? I mean, I'm going down all the way from nurses and all the way up to doctors and surgeons.
Yes, I can speak, you know, most directly to physicians and surgeons, but I know that in the other health professions, there are certainly requirements for them to do continuing education as well. What we see is that for a particular specialty, you have to do continuing education that's most relevant for you. So I want to make sure as a general internist that I'm looking at subjects like geriatrics, infectious disease, gastroenterology, cardiology, maybe very different from the subjects or the content that a thoracic surgeon or, you know, a heart surgeon may have to study. What's really interesting is that if you go state by state, different states have different requirements to have a minimum amount of content content in some particular areas. So in California, for instance, if you're an MD or a DO physician, if you have a quarter of your patients older than 65 years of age, you have to do at least 20 hours in geriatric medicine or the care of older patients. In other states and the District of Columbia, Florida, D.C., there's an HIV/AIDS education requirement. And what's nice about the ability of states to really set these different standards is it allows them to really focus on the needs of their population. So part of this is the physician or other health professional being able to self-assess, figure out where they need their continuing education, but also for that community to say, hey, we've got a very large problem with X, Y, or Z, so we think everyone should have at least a minimal amount of education on this topic after they're done their formal training. And so you see this throughout the lifetime of a physician and throughout their careers. With the exception of most states, in your first 2 years of renewing your license after you do your formal residency, you often have that CME requirement waived just because they know you've just been through 3 to 8 years of intensive training.
That is really a smart approach in terms of assessing the communities that the doctors are serving and making sure there's at least a minimum amount of continuing education serving that population. That's very reassuring. Just out of my own curiosity, how is this arranged for surgeons to have continuing education, since what they have to keep up on are skills and new procedures, and it's not simply attending a conference or doing a tutorial online? Do they actually have something set up where they practice their physical skill of performing surgery?
Increasingly, surgeons are practicing their skills, and they're being tested and evaluated on their skills. Having grown up with video games, I'm used to laparoscopic surgery and knowing how to sort of look at a screen and operate. Those are new skills for physicians who didn't train in the same era in which I did. And I think surgeons have it particularly tough because we expect them to both think and understand the basics of disease and keep up to date on those diseases, but also to be highly skilled procedurally. We have come very, very far in our ability to do simulations. Some are very high-tech simulations that they have for coursework for surgeons, where you really are looking at a screen and working with a mannequin and trying to figure out how to replace a heart valve or take out a gallbladder in a virtual setting. Others are seemingly very simple mechanical manipulations using what we use in laparoscopic surgery of little forceps and trying to move blocks or rubber bands around sets of sticks. And let me tell you, it looks easy until you actually try it. And so the American College of Surgeons, the other surgical specialty societies have experts in learning and simulation that put on these courses, and that allows surgeons to come in, ensure that they have somebody who can kind of look over their shoulder and know that their skills are being developed to do the kind of procedures that they're going to be doing in the operating room or at a minimum that they're maintained.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Take Care, a weekly conversation on health and wellness on WRVO Public Media. I'm Linda Lowen.
And I'm Lorraine Raff.
And we are talking about continuing education for medical practitioners with Dr. Atul Grover, Chief Public Policy Officer of the Association of American Medical Colleges. Dr. Grover, you've mentioned simulations. Lorraine alluded to conferences that doctors attend. What are the most common ways medical practitioners obtain their continuing education credits? Is it in a course? Is it online? Is it at conferences, face-to-face? How is it done typically?
The way that we obtain our continuing education in medicine is really changing. And so 20 years ago, my answer would have been we go to a conference, we sit there and listen to somebody lecture us for 2 days or 3 days about all the advances that have happened in internal medicine or general surgery or cardiology. But that's changed, and it's changed the same way that it's changed in medical school. We don't just sit there and lecture to people because we know now that's probably not the best way for people to learn. So there are some of these conferences in which case, you know, people will come in and really dig deep into a topic, whether it's the newest changes in how we treat electrical problems in the heart or new approaches to valve replacement of the heart or how we do lung surgery. But in many cases now, it's really practice directed, and there's a lot of flexibility in how we get our continuing education. One of the best examples, and for me as a physician, one of the most useful, is there are now point of information electronic resources so that if I am seeing a patient in my office, and this is a very real example, patient who comes in who I know has high blood pressure, is on one medication, and then their blood pressure starts going back up. Well, I need to know what the next best medicine is to add for that patient. And the literature, the amount of medical information out there is so vast that it really depends. If you're a 50-year-old Caucasian woman, it might be a different drug than what's been studied in 60-year-old African-American men. So I can now go into these vast electronic resources online, figure out all the literature and the clinical data, direct my decision-making for Mrs. Jones in front of me, and actually get medical education credit for that because I am improving my practice directly in real time. And so I think that's been one of the major changes in how we learn and how we get credit for learning.
Dr. Grover, what happens when a doctor doesn't keep up, whether it's those annual CMEs or the board certification every 10 years? Is there a mechanism for yanking something?
There sure is. And so our state medical boards don't routinely audit every physician every year, but I and others have gotten notices from our licensing boards where we've said, okay, you know, in the last 4 years, give us the documentation of all the continuing medical education credits that you've obtained. And so there's an audit process, and physicians can be sanctioned if they have not kept up with that at least minimum amount of CME that they have to do yearly, or if they have not obtained, as I mentioned in some states, the particular knowledge areas and subject courses that they have to take for meeting that state's licensing requirements. On the board certification side, I mean, this is a very rapidly changing area. I think that the different specialty boards, and there are 24 specialty boards that offer over 150 specialties, which are certified in medicine. It's really been an amazing growth compared to the 1960s when you had 10 specialties. So all of these boards are now trying to figure out how do we, in a non-intrusive way, ensure patients have the highest quality of physicians caring for them in internal medicine, in surgery, in radiology, in whatever profession that you're board certified in. And that process depends. It varies from specialty to specialty. And in most cases now, they are increasingly moving towards being able to demonstrate that you are improving the delivery of care in your own practice for your own patients. So they increasingly are making sure that it's not just I went and sat in a course for a week, but that I can demonstrate whatever I learned in that course or from looking stuff up online, my patients are actually doing better. And so there is a whole process by which people get recertified. That, again, is evolving. If they don't become recertified, in most cases, most states right now would still allow them to practice medicine. But what becomes a more difficult issue is many payers, many insurance companies will say, we're not going to pay somebody to practice medicine in our plan if they're not board certified. Or our hospitals may say, we're only going to have board-certified physicians on our medical staff. And so increasingly, the minimum requirement was the CMEs to maintain your licensure, but increasingly we're looking at people having to maintain their board certification as well if they are to meaningfully practice medicine.
As a patient, when we go to the doctor's office, very often we will see certificates framed and hung up, and it will let us know what medical school the doctor attended or where they did a fellowship or practiced early, you know, in their career. But what about board certification? And as a patient, how would we know if our doctor was keeping up on the CMEs? Or do you think that isn't something a patient should be concerned about?
I think a patient should be concerned about it. They really ought to pay attention to whether or not, I mean, you and I as patients want to make sure that for ourselves and our families that our physicians are up to date with the latest medical knowledge and skill set. So I really do think it's in the patient's interest to go online, particularly as they think about going to new physicians or refer to new physicians by their primary care doctors or by others, to just give it a look. It only takes 30 seconds to go look up the state medical board's records, and you can, from that electronic record, see whether or not the physician is still licensed in that state, and if they have any sanctions against them, whether those are not doing the required continuing medical education or some other reason. Similarly, any patient could go to the ABMS, the Association of Boards of Medical Specialties, and look up their doctors to find out if they're board certified and if they've maintained their certification. So I would certainly encourage patients to do that where they have access to that information.
Dr. Atul Grover, Chief Public Policy Officer of the Association of American Medical Colleges, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me again.